Campus FM presents the second part of Chesterton as a Journalist, a conference organised by the University of Malta and Seton Hall University. This event was dedicated to the memory of John McAuliffe, alias Roma. The guest speaker is Father Ian Boyd. Professor Peter Vassallo introduces the speaker.
We now move on to our second main speaker, and this is Father Ian Boyd, who is an internationally recognised authority on Chesterton, and who is the author of the novels of G.K. Chesterton, London, 1975. He lectures in the Department of English at Seton Hall University on the subject of sacramental themes in modern literature. He's the founder and editor of the Chesterton Review and president of the G.K. Chesterton Institute for Faith and Culture, based at Seton Hall University. It's my great pleasure to welcome him. Thank you.
Well, it's very difficult to follow as brilliant a speaker as Dr. Quinn. I just wanted to begin by saying that there was a practical side to the apparently impractical Chesterton. You may remember when he arrived on one of his visits to America, there was a press conference, and they asked the old question, that is, this was to reveal something about your literary interests. They asked him, what book would you take if you were stranded on a desert island? You know, the Bible, perhaps, the works of Shakespeare or Dante, what would it be? And Chesterton replied instantly, the book that he would take would be a book more or less entitled 101 Ways to Make a Boat. He really did enjoy life. I think one of the best comments ever made about him was made by a gloomy Czech writer, Franz Kafka, who read Chesterton without knowing a great deal about him. But Kafka made a wonderful comment. He said, I don't know who he is, but he's so happy, I can almost believe he has found God. And so he had. And then Paul Claudel, Dr. Quinn referred to him, he also did not know who this remarkable Englishman was, although eventually Claudel translated a great portion of Chesterton's orthodoxy into French and published it in one of the most prestigious French journals. But Claudel sent his publisher to meet Chesterton, and there's a wonderful letter from the publisher describing Chesterton. And the publisher said, first of all, how unprepossessing Chesterton looked. He said his complexion looked like spoilt strawberries. But he said he was, when you talked to him, he said he was always laughing, and it was as if he was speaking to a child, except you would suddenly understand that he not only understood your question, but had thought, you know, at the deepest level, his intellectual brilliance, this combination of childlike simplicity and what Bernard Shaw called colossal genius. That's what struck this emissary from Claudel. And Claudel typically admired Chesterton so much. As I say, he translated Orthodoxy, came out in 1908. Claudel brought out a French edition of it in 1909, and then the disaster. 1911, Chesterton published his first volume of Father Brown stories. This horrified Claudel. How could a great intellectual write roman policier? And Claudel said, so you see, well, this turns out the English have no interior life. But at the end, when Claudel was the French ambassador to America, it was Claudel who wrote an address of welcome when Chesterton made his second visit to America, a beautiful tribute from Claudel about what Chesterton meant to the church. He talks about floods of orthodox humor and wisdom that poured forth from this remarkable English writer. And he said, Claudel said, it was Chesterton who verified for him the truth of Christ's, the gospel saying of Christ, et ego vos, et ego refitiam vos, and I shall refresh you, and I shall refresh you. It was the refreshment, the intellectual, the joyous refreshment that Chesterton provided for the entire Catholic world. Well, I wanted, like Dr. Quinn, to say something about Chesterton as a journalist. Chesterton said, I have been and presumably always shall be a journalist. And that indeed is what he wrote. What's a journalist? I looked it up in a dictionary to make sure I had an exact definition. It wasn't much help. It just said a journalist is someone who earns his living by writing journalism. Well, all I can say is Chesterton's journalism was extraordinary. Of course, like any journalist, he commented on the events of contemporary life as he observed and experienced them. But he did much more than that, for his comments often possess a visionary quality seldom found in ordinary journalism. Everyday happenings were grist for the mill of the ordinary journalist, and they were for him. But he also saw in them sacred signs, which he set out to interpret. His best novel, The Man Who Was Thursday, there's an image in that novel used over and over again, the image of masks. All the characters are wearing masks. You don't know what their true identity is. And it is a typical of Chesterton that these terrorists, or apparent terrorists in The Man Who Was Thursday, who were plotting to take over the world, when you remove the mask, you found that each of them was a friend. And that was Chesterton's approach to life. He never met anyone he disliked. Every stranger was a potential friend. He said that the ordinary detective was always discovering the secret evil in someone or other. He preferred to be the kind of detective which found the hidden good in people. And then he added the comment Chesterton wrote, that to see good is to see God. Tells you a reminder that Chesterton was a great religious writer above all. I also think that Chesterton's most impressive writing is found not in his argumentative or controversial journalism, but in the writing in which he relied on his imagination rather than his intellect. That is, when he turned to storytelling, in one of his late novels, a character says, "I doubt that truth can be told in any way except in parable," and Chesterton's certainly proves the truth of that. As for the imagination, he explains how useful the imagination is in constructing a social philosophy. And he borrows an image from the Bible to describe this work of the imagination. Here's what he writes. A man building up an intellectual system has to build like Nehemiah, with the sword in one hand and the trowel in the other. The imagination, the constructive quality, is the trowel, and the argument is the sword. And then Chesterton adds, typically, a wide experience of actual intellectual affairs will lead most people to the conclusion that logic is mainly valuable as a weapon wherewith to exterminate logicians. In an early number of his magazine, GK's Weekly, he makes the same point in reference to his own journal. The journalism found in GK's Weekly, he insisted, was not so much scientific as artistic. The writers in his magazine, he goes on to say, would not seek to horrify readers with new and startling facts that they did not know, but rather they would strive to make them, quote, discontented with the facts they do know. This was what he meant by artistic journalism. He saw the aim of such journalism as that of finding ways to awakening the sleeping imagination. In 1929, he writes an essay entitled The Place of Nonsense in Sense, and he explains the tactics he used as a journalist in order to achieve that task. Doing so meant teaching readers to see realities they had previously taken for granted. In Chesterton's view, the problem facing the artistic journalist was therefore a double problem. First of all, the truth about the badness of the contemporary social order, a truth he sought to illuminate by his own writing, was too familiar to be seen. And secondly, those who could not see its badness were blinded by a kind of moral obtuseness. He writes, "The essential element in big business that is bad is that it is big. It is big enough to be seen, and if they do not see that, neither would they see though one rose from the dead." I think this paper, that's GK's Weekly, if it can be sustained at all, might have a scientific side dealing with the exact economic truth about trusts and trade. I still think that a great part of its method must be not so much scientific as artistic. I mean that it must awaken the imagination, and especially that extreme and almost extravagant form of imagination that can really imagine reality. The true aim of art is to awaken wonder, whether the wonder takes the form of admiration or anger. It is natural for us to say in the ordinary way of speech that monopoly is monstrous, but a certain mystical clarity of light is needed in which to see it actually as a monster. I must therefore explain in this summary of my aims, whether past or future, that we can hardly avoid having, in propaganda like this, a considerable element of fable and fantasy and all that the serious call nonsense. Believe me, it is not half so nonsensical as what they call sense. Men must be made to realize, if only by reiteration, how utterly unreal is the real state of things. Now, the fable and fantasy to which Chesterton refers in this description of what he calls propaganda, that represents the imaginative element in his journalism. So, as I say, that in one of his novels, Gabriel Gale, the central character in the 1929 novel The Poet and the Lunatics, is closely identified with Chesterton himself. In fact, Gabriel Gale undergoes the key experience which was the turning point in Chesterton's life. I wanted to say something about that in a minute. And that's the words of Gabriel Gale echoing Chesterton. Gabriel Gale says, "I doubt whether any of our action is really anything but an allegory. I doubt whether any truth can be told except in parable." To awaken a sense of wonder, as Chesterton writes, at the back of our brains, there was a forgotten blaze or burst of astonishment at our own existence. The object of the artistic and spiritual life was to dig for the submerged sunrise of wonder. Yes. Now, if this is something Chesterton had in common, it seems to me, with all great writers. Remember Conrad, Joseph Conrad, the Polish genius, explaining his aim as a writer, which really is he echoes that idea of Chesterton. Conrad wrote, "My task, which I am trying to achieve, is by the power of the written word to make you hear, to make you feel. It is, before all, to make you see." Well, Chesterton's aim, nevertheless, was fundamentally different from that of Conrad. Unlike the great Polish storyteller, Chesterton was a controversialist as well as a literary artist. He relied on fantasy as a vehicle for presenting an argument, and in doing so, he seems to imply a belief that discursive reason alone was incapable of performing this task. In a sense, he saw reason and imagination as being at odds with each other. I came across in reading, I'm proud to say, my father was an early subscriber to GK's Weekly, and I inherited his set of the magazine. And going through GK's Weekly, I came across, I suppose, a forgotten essay of Chesterton. Chesterton had attended a play in London, and it was Ibsen's play, The Master Builder, you know, about the architect who builds the spire of a church higher and higher, and then eventually falls off the spire he has built. But listen to how Chesterton turns that into an image of what's wrong with our world. There's a great deal more to be said, Chesterton writes in that essay, about Ibsen considered as a creator. The moment he is content to be a craftsman and to express himself through the images of his craft, he expresses living truths too great to be defined by the craftsman, let alone the critic. Ibsen's work had certain elements of imaginative truth which overcame all the intellectual falsehood implied by being modern. And when he thus trusted his imagination, it is curious to note how near he was to much older things than the 19th century. He was really in revolt against the 19th century, just as his doctor was in revolt against its, quote, compact majority. And then, in order to illustrate his argument, Chesterton then goes on to point out the critique of modernity implied by the very title of Ibsen's play, The Master Builder. Chesterton writes, "But not only does his very title imply the old conception of a craft, the real moral of the tragedy is the noble conception of the craftsman. It is really the great modern immorality that builders cannot climb their own towers, that men do not see the end of their work, that an indirect and servile complexity has excused the shopkeeper from living over his shop or the captain from going down in his ship. Men make machines larger than they can control, as Ibsen's hero made a tower higher than he could climb. Men grow dizzy with their own civilization as he grew giddy on his own spire. Probably, Ibsen would have defined it very imperfectly as an idea, but he made it immortal as an image. There's, however, another and a more important way in which Chesterton's use of fantasy distinguished him sharply from modernist writers such as Conrad and Ibsen. Unlike them, he was both a journalist and a religious writer. For him, the fantasy which he employed in his journalism was always an expression of what I would call a sacramental imagination. Yet it was precisely this underlying religious quality that disappointed some readers who wished that he would limit himself to creating what the great Argentinian writer Luis Borges, great admirer of Chesterton, Borges didn't like that religious element in Chesterton. And he says Chesterton created mysteries and explanations of a demoniacal or magical sort. And then Borges goes on to say, I think offensively, that Chesterton subordinated his imagination to his Catholic faith, which Borges calls a collection of Hebrew imaginings that had been subjected to Plato and Aristotle. Well, what Borges conspicuously failed to understand is that it was precisely this subordination of his mind and imagination to an objective, truth-telling authority outside himself that provided Chesterton's best writing with its remarkable power. Let me explain why this was so. There was a deeply psychological reason why Chesterton wanted an external authority, that he needed it. I think his entire life can be understood as an effort to escape from, we have to use a technical word here, from a solipsistic nightmare. Here's what happened. He was a student, as I'm sure many of you know. He did not go to university. Well, he did go to the University of London to the Slade School of Art. His parents noticed that he had a genius for drawing. They thought he would be an artist. And I think that in a sense is true, that for Chesterton, the image, the imagination, was the organ of perception. I remember coming across in my Chesterton research, coming across a little verse Chesterton wrote in a picture book that he gave to a little child, a little boy, for his birthday. And in it, Chesterton wrote this little verse, and the verse said, among other things, that of course the little boy was too small even to read. And Chesterton said, well, never you mind, you can't read, you can see, and all directness is divine. And then he goes on to give the little boy advice. And he says, so mind your books, my little man, and listen to the pedants, you know, the pedants, these tiresome people who think they know everything. And so mind your books, my little man, and listen to the pedants, screeds, and strictures, but don't believe in anything that can't be told in colored pictures. So, a reality. What happened? As I say, he was at the Slade School of Art, and he underwent a psychological crisis. Now, he describes this, he devotes an entire chapter in his autobiography with the significant title, How to Be a Lunatic. Well, don't be deceived by that joking chapter heading, because this really was a serious mental crisis, a mental problem. Here's what Chesterton writes. At a very early age, I had thought my way back to thought itself. It is a very dreadful thing to do, for it may lead to thinking that there is nothing but thought. At this time, I did not very clearly distinguish between dreaming and waking, not only as a mood, but as a metaphysical doubt. I felt as if everything might be a dream. It was as if I had myself projected the universe from within, with all its trees and stars. And that is so near to the notion of being God that is meant that it is manifestly even nearer to going mad. So he came to the conclusion that nothing existed outside his own mind, that London, his friends, his family, the universe, he had created and had projected it outwardly. It's an experience, among other things, of total loneliness, of being all alone. Of course, he puts it humorously. One of the fellow students came up to him one day and said, students are like this, he said, I no longer believe in God. Chesterton said, I smiled. How could I tell him I no longer believed in him? If he stopped thinking about him, he would stop existing. You'll find this all throughout Chesterton's writing. For example, in an early poem, he has a poem entitled "The Mirror of Madmen." And here's a stanza from that poem: "I dreamed a dream of heaven, white as frost, the splendid stillness of a living host, vast choirs of upturned faces, line o'er line. Then my blood froze, for every face was mine." Now, this solipsistic nightmare, this theme recurs throughout all his writing. The Man Who Is Thursday, surely his best novel, has a subtitle, a significant subtitle, A Nightmare. So in The Man Who Is Thursday, Chesterton is dealing with the age-old problem of the meaning of suffering. That is, he writes the book, he publishes the book in 1908, and in the book he's looking back at this nightmare experience of solipsism, and he asks himself an interesting question. Of course he recovered. By 1908, he was one of the most famous writers in the English-speaking world. He was happily married. He had found Christian faith, a Catholic faith, although it took him years to be in full communion with the church that he truly believed in. But he asks himself this question. I realize it was all nonsense, of course, this dream that I had created the world. But he said, I suffered. So I want, he's just like Job. By the way, Chesterton's favorite book in the Bible, the book of Job. So like Job, Chesterton questions God and says, I want to know, one of the characters in The Man Who Is Thursday says, to Sunday, who in a way represents God, the characters are named for the days of the week. I think it's Tuesday. Gogol, the character, says to Sunday, God, if you like, I want to know why I was hurt so much. Yeah. That's the question Chesterton wanted to know. The question of Job, and as Muriel Spark says, the only problem worth asking in philosophy. So, In that novel, Chesterton writes a poem which he dedicates to a dear friend of his, E.C. Bentley, also a journalist who wrote for a conservative paper, The Morning Post, and then the Telegraph. He was on the editorial page, but that's all by the way. He writes to Bentley, who sort of helped him out of this solipsistic crisis, and here's the verse in which he celebrates his escape from solipsism. Chesterton writes, "Between us, by the peace of God, such truth can now be told." Yes, in 1908, he can now look back to what happened in 1894. "Between us, by the peace of God, such truth can now be told. Yea, there is strength in striking root, and good in growing old." Well, he was only in his early 30s, but still. "We have found," Chesterton writes, "we have found common things at last." You know, that's central to Chesterton's philosophy, what people have in common, the common things. "We have found common things at last, and marriage and a creed. And I may safely write it now, and you may safely read." The underlying principle which gives coherence and unity to Chesterton's journalism is his distributist philosophy. He did have a coherent philosophy. His journalism did not consist in random and unconnected thoughts. His philosophy has already been well summarized by Professor Quinn, I'll just repeat it, that the distributism, a kind of ugly name for a sound philosophy, his philosophy was simply this, that a sound social order must be based on the family and on the widest possible distribution of property. The family. Now, that's essential. Chesterton was a liberal, but he did not believe in liberal individualism. He thought that human beings could only be fully human in a community, and the fundamental community was the family, older than the state, and must be protected from the infringements of state power. Okay, if you want, call it philosophical anarchism. Chesterton thought there was a lot to be said for philosophical anarchism, and he thought it worked very well in the ordinary family. You know, families don't have constitutions. The husband and wife, I mean, they work things out. And, you know, they don't have to have a Jefferson or someone to write a constitution. They just go ahead. So his philosophy emphasized smallness, localism, self-government, and that was logically enough combined with a distaste for both state socialism and monopoly capitalism. In fact, for him, socialism and capitalism, he called them two forms of gigantism, which he thought were virtually indistinguishable. The ugly twins, he called them. All throughout Chesterton, you get these sayings, aphorisms. They're just like flashes of prophetic insight. He understood that socialism set up in Moscow could not last. And he wrote once that the madness of tomorrow is far more in Manhattan than in Moscow. Yeah. And then he wrote, the next great heresy is going to be an attack on morality, and especially sexual morality. And he said, if people cannot see that, they cannot read the signs of the time, the advertisements in Fleet Street, and in Manhattan, in the newspapers for which he wrote, and in the mass media that was developing. He followed a philosophy which had been expounded by his close friend Hilaire Belloc in a remarkable book. George Orwell pays tribute to it. Belloc wrote a book in 1912 entitled The Servile State, Here's what Belloc wrote, that the mere capitalist anarchy cannot endure, Belloc writes, is patent to all men, that only a very few possible solutions to it exist should be equally patent to all. For my part, Belloc concludes, as I have said in these pages, I do not believe there are more than two solutions. One, a reaction towards well-divided property or the reestablishment of servitude, slavery. Now, Chesterton's intellectual debt to Belloc was immense. It can be detected in all his journalism. Nevertheless, Chesterton made his own contribution to Belloc's distributist theory. After all, Chesterton's first work in Christian sociology, What's Wrong with the World, a kind of manifesto of distributist thinking, predates Belloc's Servile State by 2 years. That is, What's Wrong with the World was published in 1910. Now, like the Servile State, it was also an enormously influential work. Unlike the Servile State, its ideas were essentially religious as well as economic. The books have a power, as Kipling said at a luncheon where Chesterton was the person who introduced him. Kipling says, "Only words will live. Only our words will live." Not very good theology, maybe, but it does say something about the power of a writer. And here we are, so long, many years after Chesterton's death, considering him because he was a writer whose words will surely live. Now, I knew when I was a student at the University of Toronto, a remarkable Chestertonian, Marshall McLuhan. I'm not sure how well he's remembered. We think of him as the great person who celebrated the mass, media. The medium is the message, and so on. Well, McLuhan studied at Cambridge University, and he was converted to Catholicism by reading Chesterton's sociological book, What's Wrong with the World. And that book really doesn't contain a word about Catholicism. Interesting. The sacramental mind, where you present religious truth without talking about religion. Remember Father Faber, who wrote those rather sentimental hymns and so on, an Oratorian priest, a holy man, really, but one of his exasperated confreres at the London Oratory said, Father Faber knew Wordsworth and the early Romantic writers, and this priest, his fellow priest, said, Father Faber is a wonderful man if you could keep him off the subject of religion. Well, Chesterton kept off the subject of religion in one sense, and yet was always religious. His devout wife, Frances, said to him one day, "Gilbert, why don't you write more about God?" And Chesterton said, "Frances, I never write about anything else." Yeah. So everything he wrote, in his 75 or so books and thousands of uncollected pieces of journalism, were religious writing, deeply religious writing. C.S. Lewis, another writer who was really converted to Christianity, if not to Catholicism, by reading Chesterton, gives a warning to people about reading Chesterton. Lewis, wounded in the First World War, was in a military hospital, and he happened to pick up a Chesterton book, which changed his life, converted him, as I say. And Lewis says, an atheist has to be very careful about what he reads. Yeah. He says, Lewis says, God is so unscrupulous, he puts books into your hands that will change your life. So Lewis was a devotee of Chesterton. So you have McLuhan, Lewis, Ronald Knox, the writer, again, not perhaps as well remembered as he should be, used to receive, himself a convert to Catholicism, used to receive many, many people into the Catholic Church to give them instructions of the Catholic faith. And he said he always asked the same question at the beginning of the conversation. Have you read any Catholic books? And he said always, without exception, the book mentioned something by Chesterton. I think an old priest that I knew used to put it this way. He said, if you find someone reading Chesterton, he is not far from the kingdom of God. Well, I could, I suppose, if I wanted to keep on talking much longer, talk about, weaknesses in Chesterton's writings. I wrote a book about his novels, and I really cannot claim that he is, a novelist like Conrad, but he never tried to be. He was always a journalist. In the language of E.M. Forster, Chesterton's characters are flat rather than fully rounded. And Chesterton explains that, of course, he didn't write about people in his novels. His characters represented ideas. And then he said he preferred to present human beings as ideas or notions, wrestling naked, as it were, and not dressed up in a masquerade as men and women. For Chesterton understood the theological truth that when it comes right down to it, only the dreams of God are truly material. We are the dreams of God. As I say, he does return again and again in his books, in his novels, and in his journalism to some extent, to his mental crisis. Take, for example, his 1910 novel, The Ball and the Cross. And by the way, another example of journalism. This novel was serialized. This was 1910. Chesterton was still an Anglican. He'd call himself an Anglo-Catholic when he wrote it. And the novel was serialized in an Anglican magazine, or part of it was. In this novel, The Ball and the Cross, all the characters find themselves in the end imprisoned in the garden of a madhouse. And there they meet a man who's just like the young Chesterton. It's a man who thinks he's God, someone truly crazy. Now, the characters finally escape from the madhouse. And the fact that they do does not altogether remove the disturbing suggestion that the modern world is just such a madhouse, a universal lunatic asylum from which there is no easy escape, an institution in which one is likely to meet insane solipsists, a sinister garden. And yet, you know, as Kafka said, he's so happy. His gardens, and there are many of them in his books, are not usually sinister. Chesterton says somewhere that he believes we're still in the Garden of Eden, that all that's happened is our eyesight has been damaged, and we can't understand the beauty of the world that surrounds us. Chesterton believed that the trouble with the modern world, and he represents this in another novel, his first one, The Napoleon of Notting Hill. But that novel has a wonderful opening line. It goes something like this. The human race to which so many of my readers belong, and so on. Anyway, in the Napoleon of Notting Hill, he has two characters, he usually does, and King Oberon. The novel is set, interestingly enough, in 1984. Did Orwell have that in mind? I think probably not, but it's an interesting coincidence. And in this world of 1984, England is run by a monarch, King Oberon. And they choose the monarch just by picking a name out of a hat, so to speak. And King Oberon doesn't believe in anything except humor, except a joke. Now, as a joke, King Oberon decides that England should go back to the Middle Ages. It's just a joke. But a young fanatic, Oberon Quinn, reads what the king has said and takes it seriously. This young man has no sense of humor at all. So you have a humorist who invents a philosophy as a joke, and then you have a young man without any humor who implements the joke. Seriousness and humor. And at the end of the novel, when Notting Hill, there's been a revolution, they set up this medieval kingdom, and it ends in war and disaster. And at the end of it, the two characters set out together. And here's what the king says to Adam Wayne, the political fanatic, or rather Adam Wayne, the political fanatic, explains to the cynical king, Oberon Quinn, that something is going to unite us, something that is outside us, something that you and I have all our lives, perhaps, taken too little account of. The equal and eternal human being will alter that antagonism. In other words, in the modern world, the problem is the people who are serious are fanatics. You know, Lenin, Hitler, how prophetic Chesterton was in 1904. And the men who are funny are not serious. They live for a joke. And so what you have to have, Chesterton says, is a combination of seriousness and humor. He puts it this way in Heretics. The opposite of being funny is not being serious. You know what the opposite of being funny is? Being not funny. So you can be funny and serious, or funny and not serious, and so on. You can get any kind of combination. But Adam Wayne says, we are the two essentials, that is, humor and seriousness, have been separated in the modern world. Let us travel the world together. So Chesterton, I find a kind of contradiction here. Chesterton was a liberal, and he really believed in the common man. He kind of idealizes the common man. In the Napoleon of Notting Hill, he says, the common man whom mere geniuses like you and me can only worship like a god. So the wise man is the ordinary human being who does not have political power. And yet, Chesterton also believed in original sin. For example, he has this wonderful criticism of his friend H.G. Wells, who's the father of English science fiction, describing these utopias. Everything is going to be set right, you know. A society so perfect, as T.S. Eliot was to say, so perfect a structure that no one had to be good. Yeah. Well, here's what Chesterton says about such socialist utopias. In his new utopia, Chesterton writes in 1905, he, H.G. Wells, a good friend of his, by the way, says, for instance, that a chief point of the utopia will be a disbelief in original sin. And Chesterton says, if he had begun with the human soul, that is, if he had begun with himself, he would have found original sin almost the first thing to be believed in. He would have found, to put the matter shortly, that a permanent possibility of selfishness arises from the mere fact of having a self, and not from any accidents of education or ill treatment. The weakness of all utopias is this, that they take the greatest difficulty of man, original sin, and assume it to be overcome, and then give an elaborate account of the overcoming of the smaller ones. I wish when we talked about Chesterton as a journalist, that we had time to talk about his friendships with his intellectual enemies, H.G. Wells, who wrote such insulting things to Chesterton, and then Chesterton writes a letter back to him, which is so, Wells had insulted his brother, who died in the First War. You can imagine how hurt Chesterton was. But nevertheless, he wrote back a graceful letter to Wells. And then Wells wrote to him and said, "It's impossible to quarrel with you. I just can't." And he said, "I don't believe in God. But if I'm wrong, and there is a God, I hope I can get to heaven because I was your friend." The question I ask myself is how it's possible to reconcile Chesterton's praise for an apparently flawless common man with Chesterton's assertion that original sin afflicts all systems and all people. The contradiction, I guess, is really impossible to resolve without making an appeal to a theological principle that was dear to Chesterton, a principle central to his sacramental thinking. According to this principle, the common man is not really the creation of a populist's imagination. For Chesterton, the common man is a sacramental man. That is, all those baptized, all those who have that share in divine life which comes with baptism, they have within them Christ himself, reenacting his life, the life described in the four Gospels. Because this is so, it really is proper for others to worship and adore the common man. You remember what C.S. Lewis said on this subject, the following memorable and I think Chestertonian words. C.S. Lewis wrote, "Next to the Blessed Sacrament itself, your neighbor is the holiest object presented to your senses. If he is your Christian neighbor, he is holy in almost the same way, for in him also Christ, veri latitat, Christ is truly hidden, the glorifier and the glorified, glory himself is truly hidden." So I think the deepest meaning of what's meant by calling Chesterton the journalist a sacramental writer is exactly that. The distributist philosophy which gives unity to all his journalism is a religious philosophy. Its fundamental principle is an assertion about the divine dignity of the ordinary man and the ordinary human life. And Chesterton's social criticism is also religious. He talks about walking through an English slum, and he regrets, as a Catholic, that the English did not have any religious statues or crucifixes, you know, on the roadsides, because they were Protestant. They had no public religious art. But Chesterton said, as he walked through the slum, he said, "I saw no crucifixes, but many crucifixions." This is Chesterton's sacramental thinkers, the sacramental thinking. Chesterton's journalism, I think, can be summarized in a single passage taken from his first manifesto. He had written, Virginia Woolf famously suggested that we should look within. And Chesterton, in What's Wrong with the World, says, "Don't look within. Look out the window and notice the first man who walks by. The liberals may have swept England with an overwhelming majority, but you would not stake a button that the man is a liberal, the man you happen to see. The Bible may be read in all schools and respected in all law courts." How we wish it were. But you would not bet a straw that he believes in the Bible. But you would bet your week's wages, let us say, that he believes in wearing clothes. You would bet that he believes that physical courage is a fine thing, or that parents should have authority over children. Of course, Chesterton writes, he might be the millionth man who does not believe these things. If it comes to that, he might be the bearded lady dressed up as a man. But these prodigies are quite a different thing from any mere calculation of numbers. Well, there it is. The first man you see from the window, Chesterton says, he is the key king of England. Like Lewis, Chesterton believed in the hidden glory of this first man who walks by. It is for him that Chesterton writes his journalism. As Charles Williams explains, Chesterton is on the side of God and the people. But in a sense, both his great allies are voiceless and unarmed. It is Chesterton who is their song and their weapon, and his weapon is his song. In a word, Chesterton's journalism is the work of a religious thinker who spoke for the inarticulate and weaponless man on the street, and who defended him most effectively when he used the weapons of parable and fantasy. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to the second part of Chesterton as a Journalist, a conference organized by the University of Malta and Seton Hall University. This event was dedicated to the memory of John McAuliffe, alias Roma. The guest speaker was Father Ian Boyd.